Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Over the past 3 months, artists, writers, and other cultural workers in the United States and Europe have faced a backlash after expressing solidarity for Palestine as Israel has continued its relentless assault on Gaza. Talks and performances have been cancelled, artworks deinstalled, exhibits removed, and livelihoods threatened. Today we speak with two Palestinian-American artists. One was cancelled by her own alma mater, Indiana University. The other was cancelled in Berlin. We begin with Samia Halabi, a renowned Palestinian visual artist, activist, educator, and scholar. Samia Halabi's first U.S. retrospective, which had taken 3 years to organize, was abruptly canceled by Indiana University's Ashkenazi Museum of Art over her criticism of Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which she's described as a genocide. Before we speak with Samia about what happened, let's turn to a short documentary about her life and work by Palestinian-Jordanian filmmaker Munir Atala. This is Samia talking about moving with her family to the United States as a teenager from Palestine.
In 1951, my father and mother had come to the decision that it was safer to bring their family up in the U.S. I did not want to come. I was 14 and was to high school. I couldn't decide between the sciences. It was my mother who finally said, "You always loved art. Why don't you study art?" I gained tenure at Indiana University and decided that really I wanted to be in New York, but it's hard to just pick up and have no money and come to New York, a city I don't know anybody or anything in. I moved in 76. I continued trying to get a gallery for years. It was total rejection. In this world, people don't see, if you're Palestinian, don't see what you make. They see you. And they don't like us Palestinians.
This is another clip of Samia talking about the process of creating her art and how abstraction can result from a new way of seeing.
I work on 2, 3, sometimes 4 or 5 paintings at the same time. When I enter, I get going. Then the paintings begin to permeate my consciousness. The paintings do not arise out of feeling. They arise out of thinking. And I'm very scientific in the way I think and plan. But when I do them, I trust my intuitions.
Fulfilling every whim that comes along.
Balancing back and forth between what I intuit is right and what I want to do. And which one wins is hard to tell. When a thing, painting is going badly, I'm feeling badly. But not because my feeling is in the painting. I'm reacting to frustration. But when it's going well, I'm very happy because I've captured something I've wanted to capture. As I was saying about Palestine, something remains that I almost feel it with my hands. I can make it. I put it in a painting. But it's not a photographic image. It's what remains visually in memory. It's something palpable and real. What your iPhone or cell phone is telling you when you take a picture is only a teeny slice of what is in front of it when you take the picture. It's an image of a fragment of time of reality. But a new abstraction can result from a new way of seeing.
An excerpt of Samia Halabi, a video portrait, a short documentary about the Palestinian-American artist's life and work. Samia Halabi's paintings are in the permanent collections of the Guggenheim Museum in New York, the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., and the Art Institute of Chicago. And Samia joins us today in New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now! We've told a bit of the story, but you are one of the most prestigious Palestinian-American artists in these permanent art collections around the country. You were doing this life retrospective at your alma mater, Indiana University, worked on it for 3 years, Samia. Can you tell us what happened right before it was to open?
Thank you, Amy. I'm really pleased to be with you and to tell my story and tell the story of what happened, which is very important also to the community in Bloomington and Indiana. Just immediately before, after a lot of work preparing, first I heard a little rumble that someone was paying attention to the fact that I'm Palestinian. Other than that, I had expected, being an alumna and a one-time professor who had been awarded tenure, to be somewhat immune, because I knew the atmosphere in the country. And so the sudden cancellation came as a surprise. It was amazing to know that they would go ahead and act in this way, when a catalog that's 1 inch thick and hardcover had been printed and delivered. Plans for the opening were being made. The artwork was picked up by the shippers. Everything was done in so beautifully, in excellent museum fashion, that suddenly, after the few days after the pickup of the paintings, I hear a very brief notice, a two-sentence letter saying the show is canceled and the art will be returned to me. I wrote two letters suggesting in very friendly terms that they reverse this decision, but I have not heard a word back from them. And, you know, Amy, this was a twin retrospective committed to my relationship to the Midwest. The Midwest had been a place where I had felt was my second home. I really enjoyed my education there. I arrived in the U.S. at age 14. I'm 87 now. And I remember the University of Cincinnati with a great deal of affection for the great education we received there. I remember it being an atmosphere that was very open and radical. My teachers were all inspired by the resistant painters of the time, like Ben Shahn. They were in admiration of the industrial union movement. The Great Depression was still in people's memory. And the professors were all very enlightened and advanced and talked a lot about academic freedom. My feeling is I wished I could bring that batch of attitudes on those professors to to contemporary American education. Maybe I'm going on too long, Amy, but my feeling towards what happened to me is that the administration has lost sight of their responsibility to the community, to the students who are there. They're trying to stop students from moving forward with thinking, with their creative process politically. And that's they're being more responsible to pronouncements from the government and from threats, perhaps, from parts of the government, but not at all responsible. A division is taking place in their position of being having administrative power, but no responsibility to the real community. I feel the students, the repression of the students right now in the country who are the most advanced. The new partnership between the young Palestinians and all they're doing, and the young Jews who and all that they are doing. They're so disciplined and determined and clear thinking. I'm really in admiration for them. And I think this act is of suspension, of cancellation, is as much against them as it is against me and the curator of the show. We mustn't forget about the curator. A curator beginning their career to whom this was a very important show, Elliot Reichert, who was magnificent in his, as was all the staff at the museum, magnificent in their effort. So I'm very.
Samia Halabi, we'd like to get your response to the formal explanation that Indiana University, your alma mater, where you received your master's degree, the formal response that the university gave to why your show was canceled. The university provost, Rahul Srivastav, spoke at a faculty council meeting and addressed the backlash over the decision to cancel your show. He called your exhibit a, quote, potential lightning rod that could incite protests, and said the 3 months for it to be on view would require long-term security, adding, quote, I have to make a decision on keeping a project, a program going when there is a risk of violence or a risk of other incidents. I would err on the side of caution. So, Samia Halabi, your response to that?
Well, my response to that is, first of all, they never gave me a reason, and they never responded. And they never even talked to me. So I got the impression that they didn't like my, from a very brief phone call with the director of the museum, that one way or the other, my general attitude and support of Palestine and criticism of Israel and U.S. Partnership, U.S.-Israel attacking Palestine, and especially the massacre, the unbelievable massacre in Gaza, both destruction of people and of culture, that my anger with that and my support of the Palestinians was the cause. I think this idea that they're so terrorized or frightened by the me being a lightning rod and the show bringing, I think the students, to their majority, were for the show. They would have been delighted to see the show. I think this idea of a lightning rod for trouble is their imagination, their invention. It's just a propaganda, invention. I don't see that. You know, museums guard their work, always guard what is there, and they could have put a second guard on the show if that's they're so frightened. But canceling it, considering all of the grants they received, all the expenses they went through, it's just not reflective of this kind of fear. Museums all over are concerned about art. So that's my reaction to that. You know, I would like to say some more about what's happening in Gaza, because it connects to art. First of all, I do want to say that this is much larger than I am. There's suppression of students throughout the U.S. There's suppression of faculty. There's one faculty member at Indiana University who's been censured for a very minor thing as an excuse for his true open-mindedness and support of young students. To me, the young students, I wanted to go to that point,
Samia. I'm looking at a piece in The Nation magazine. On December 15th, Indiana University suspended Professor Abdulkader Sino, a tenured faculty member who's taught at IU for almost two decades and who, until his suspension, was the faculty advisor of the PSC. The supposed reason for the suspension, alleged mistakes in the filing of a room reservation form to support a PSC event, a scheduled public lecture by Miko Peled, an Israeli-American IDF veteran and peace activist. I mean, this is amazing. You know, Miko Peled is the son of General Peled, who, well-known in Israel, fought in 1948 and in the Six-Day War. Miko Peled was going to speak. And so the alleged mistakes led the administration to demand cancellation of the event 2 days before it was scheduled. They went forward anyway. It proceeded without a hitch until the administration claimed it was an unauthorized event and the professor suspended. Samia Halabi.
You know, my feeling is that they indict themselves with their own words when they suspend someone and they say the reason is he did something made a minor mistake in filling a form requesting space for the event, it is ridiculous. You don't suspend a professor for that kind of thing, and then you make you create a whole range of excuses to defend the real reason. And it's similar to my case. You know, in his case, they're accusing him of misfilling a form. In my case, they're saying they need they're worried that this my show is a lightning rod to hostile activity against the show or discord in among the students. So it doesn't make sense to me that they suspend someone who is so highly respected by the students and beloved of the students. It is unforgivable. Again, it's an indication that there is a huge gap growing between administrative layers and the government and the students, professors, workers, staff, and general population in this country. You see it very clearly. You see huge demonstrations, not only in the U.S., but all over the world. And disregard, this whole disregard of governments to what the people are asking for is in miniature form taking place at Indiana University. And it is this very thing I'm talking about, this division in the minds of administrators that they no longer owe anything to the students and to the faculty or to an open atmosphere of learning and discourse, as though disagreement, differences of opinion is a negative thing. It is a kind of attempted mind control. You know, you can only think that way, and then you're okay, and you can be a student. But if you want to discourse and think, see other points of view, you're not allowed. So it's very backward, very backward.
We want to bring in another Palestinian-American artist into this discussion, the artist and filmmaker Emily Jassir. She was scheduled to speak at an event in Berlin, Germany, in October, but her appearance was canceled. She's the recipient of prestigious awards, including a Golden Lion at the Venice Biennale, a Prince Klaus Award from the Prince Klaus Fund in The Hague, the Hugo Boss Prize at the Guggenheim Museum. And most recently, she won an American Academy of Arts and Letters Prize and received an honorary doctorate from the National College of Art and Design in Dublin, Ireland. She's the founding director of Dar Yusuf Nasri Jassir for Art and Research in Bethlehem, where she was born. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Emily. It's very good to have you with us. Can you talk about what's happened to you, actually not here in the United States, but in Berlin, Germany?
Thank you, Amy, for having me on your show. It's really a pleasure to be here. I also just would like to begin by expressing my solidarity for Samia and the loss of her show, but also for the curator, Elliot, because he was in Bethlehem last summer and spoke to me at length about this exhibition, so I was quite excited about it. I was slated to speak in Berlin as part of a workshop at Potsdam University. And when they canceled the talk, they wrote to me and said they were going to postpone it to a more peaceful time or to a more peaceful point in time, which now listening to Samia speaking about the idea of being a lightning rod, this really resonated with me. And this is one of the methodologies that is being used to actually stop us from being able to speak publicly and share our words and share our work. This is another way of doing it, is by saying, oh, we'll just do this in another peaceful time. But this is the time. This is the time when we should be speaking and having discourse across the board around the world. So I don't buy that that was the real reason. Again, we have to also take the curator into consideration and try to imagine what kind of pressure, particularly being in Germany, they must have been under. The situation in Germany, as we all know, is one of the most extreme cases of silencing Palestinians. But it's part of a larger war effort targeting Palestinian voices and intellectuals using various methodologies, including harassment, baseless smear campaigns, canceling shows, canceling talks. So it's very much part of a coordinated movement.
Emily Jassir, could you talk about some of the, there have been numerous incidents in Germany where people have been canceled for one reason or another having to do with Gaza. If you could just go through some of those people, in particular, the Palestinian artists and writers.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the first incidents was Adania Shibli, who was slated to receive an award in Germany. That was within the first week of October, if I remember correctly. The list is quite extensive. My sister's film, Anne-Marie Jasser, was canceled within weeks also. I think her film was canceled. It's a film about a wedding, and it was deemed too controversial to show on German television. Candice Brights, as we all know, is another person. There's so many. The list is endless.
Meanwhile, more than 500 global artists, filmmakers and writers and culture workers have announced a push against Germany's stance on Israel's war in Gaza, calling on artists to step back from collaborating with German state-funded associations. The campaign's backed by the French author, Nobel Prize for Literature winner Annie Ernaux, and the Palestinian poet and activist Mohammed El-Kurd. It alleges Germany has adopted, quote, McCarthyist policies that suppress freedom of expression, specifically expressions of solidarity with Palestine, unquote. We're speaking with Emily Jassir, whose speech was just canceled in Berlin, Germany. And as we wrap up with you, Emily, I wanted to know if you could comment on what's happening in your birthplace in Bethlehem. The last time we went to Bethlehem, we were interviewing two pastors there, one of them who set up Christ in the Rubble, a crèche scene that showed the baby Jesus in rubble signifying Gaza. If you can talk about that and the importance of your art as you continue.
Yeah, I will talk about that, but just to relate back to what everyone else was talking about and how you started, I think it's really important to consider the way this attempt at creating a culture of fear amongst the arts community globally and internationally is happening through these baseless smear campaigns and other and defamation, threatening people's jobs. And I mentioned this just because, you know, one of the things that happened to me was that there was a letter writing campaign in which every university I've ever taught at internationally, anyone that's ever given me an award, received literally a 5-page PDF claiming that I was an ISIS terrorist that supports the rape of women and the killing of babies. People who signed that art form letter, that, and many, many, many of whom were Jewish and Israeli allies that I have worked with for 25 years, also received that letter. In my case, because people know me, they've worked with me for 25 years, the letters come off as just absolutely absurd and ridiculous. But if that is happening to me, it begs the question of what is happening to younger artists, people in museums don't know receiving letters like that. And it's very targeted and very systematic. And it's something to consider also in relationship with the targeted destruction of culture in Gaza, art centers being bombed. Why would an art center be bombed? Because part of genocide is precisely silencing artists and silencing a cultural production. And I feel that that was very important to say that. In Bethlehem, the situation is quite difficult, nothing compared to Gaza, of course, but we are witnessing incursions every night. It's been, you know, Bethlehem is a town that very, very much relies on visitors and tourists for its economy. So that economically, it's been a disaster. As an art center, our art center in Bethlehem promotes dance and music and art practices and making and residencies of local artists and international artists. We're doing our very best to both deal with the situation at hand, but also provide a kind of way of working with the children now who live in our neighborhood, who are trying to handle the situation, both on the ground in Bethlehem, but also witnessing what's happening to Gaza.
Emily Jassir, we want to thank you for being with us. Acclaimed artist and filmmaker, born in Bethlehem, goes back and forth between Bethlehem and New York, was scheduled to speak in Berlin, Germany, her talk canceled. And Samia Halabi, renowned Palestinian visual artist, activist, educator, and scholar, whose first U.S. retrospective was abruptly canceled by Indiana University's Eskenazi Museum of Art over her support for Palestinians and criticism of Israel's bombardment of Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the acclaimed Chinese artist and activist Ai Weiwei. In November, he had an exhibit in London canceled after he wrote a social media post where he criticized the United States for its longtime financial support of Israel. Ai Weiwei has previously expressed support for Palestinians. He made a 2016 documentary that includes Gaza in the global refugee crisis called Human Flow. Ai Weiwei is one of the world's most acclaimed artists. In 2011, he was arrested at the Beijing airport, held for 81 days without charge. He's been living in exile since 2015. He's joining us here in New York City ahead of his event tonight at Town Hall. That's part of PEN America's PEN Out Loud series, when he'll discuss his new graphic memoir, Zodiac. Ai Weiwei, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's start with that canceled London exhibit. What happened?
Well, and after I post, a single line on Twitter, you know, I never noticed people really become so sensitive or so crazy about my post. Basically, post that described the situation about Israelis' relations with U.S. and which is it's very subjective. It's not from my point of view, but it's really a general facts. So then the galleries are actually not one gallery, but galleries in Paris and in London, they get very worried. And I still don't know exact the reason why they have to worry about artists. A single line, you know, but rather they says they want to avoid this kind of argument and they're trying to protect my interests. So they postponed my shows, not one, but altogether four shows. So I guess that proved what I'm saying on Twitter is correct, because there's all over in the world, this strong censorship about different voices and towards this kind of conflicts, and the conflicts continues getting so massive and also seems it's not going to stop. So by doing that, many of my shows been canceled, so.
Were you surprised by the reaction, given that you've been not only are you one of the most celebrated artists from China in the West, but also you've been a vocal supporter of the Palestinians for years?
I am surprised. I think we are should live in a more free society, and which can allow the different opinions and the voice, but to have this kind of devastating case to in dealing with art community, not only art community, but also films or literature. I think it is, it shows a really very bad, backwards in terms of freedom of expression, human rights, and, all those issues.
There are not many Chinese artists as celebrated and embraced by the West as you are, Ai Weiwei. Were you surprised by the swift retaliation against your position, which is really critiquing the West in London, Britain, and the U.S. when it comes to supporting the Israeli government, when it comes to the assault on Gaza?
I think maybe I was celebrated for wrong reason, but still, as an artist, I have to fight for the human dignity and also basic human rights, freedom of speech, and that's why I'm here. So,
can I ask you about your graphic novel, Ai Weiwei? Talk about Zodiac and the message you're conveying in this graphic memoir.
Well, thanks for asking that. I come to New York to be part of this graphic novel, the promotion. And the novel is take us about 2-3 years with two other person involved. And so we made the drawing and the storyline, and it's very I think it's pretty unique and also charming in telling my personal stories in relate to Chinese classic stories, but also in relating to current event both in China and in the West. So it's a very detailed, very visual narratives about the stories.
Ai Weiwei, your message to the world right now, you are a dissident when it comes to China. You cannot live inside China. You're in exile. And now, when you come and are embraced by the West, you find yourself canceled again and again. Your thoughts?
Well, I think we are living in a very crucial time. Globally, we have to rethink about our values or what we are really defending for. It's not only a challenge for individual artists, but also for the state. And we are gradually losing the ground of democracy or personal freedom, or even we are still in facing a crisis, economic crisis, immigration crisis. Also, we are possibly at the edge of the World War III. You know, this is not an exaggeration. It can happen. And I'm afraid this is the facts. But that would calling for every individual to defend the humanity and the human rights.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ai Weiwei, world-renowned Chinese artist and activist, has a new graphic memoir called Zodiac. He'll be speaking tonight at Town Hall in New York.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Boutu. On October the 27th, Israel cut off all phone and internet communications to the Gaza Strip, further plunging the Gaza Strip into darkness. The cutting of internet and phone communications meant that vital life-saving systems, such as ambulances, rescuers, and hospitals, could not be reached to treat the injured
or to rescue those trapped under the rubble. Cutting off internet also meant that Israel's crimes would be carried out in the dark. But in the midst of this, the volunteer initiative called Connecting Gaza was formed, led by Mirna Al-Helbawi. Mirna is an author and activist who decided to set up a system for donors around the world to purchase eSIMs, or virtual SIM cards, to help Palestinians skirt telecommunications blackouts amid Israeli bombing across the Gaza Strip. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip use the only carrier that is available there, which is called Jawal for cell phones and Paltel for landlines. And like everything in the Gaza Strip, Israel has the ability to control whether Jawal and Paltel can operate. But by using eSIMs, Palestinians can effectively roam on other carriers, whether Egyptian, Israeli, or otherwise, and remain connected. Connecting Gaza first began by connecting medical personnel and journalists, but was later expanded to connect anyone in Gaza. Donors purchase an eSIM from one of the providers listed by Connecting Gaza, and the eSIM is then donated to someone in Palestine. In today's episode, we speak with Mirna and learn more about this initiative.
Mirna, thank you so much for joining us today on This is Palestine. You've started this incredible initiative to connect Gaza to the rest of the world, particularly at a time when we saw that the Israelis had done everything from cutting off fuel, cutting off electricity, cutting off water supply. We then later heard about these attempts to cut off the internet, the landline services, and all of these very essential services that are needed in Gaza. Now, you, of course, then stepped in and began an initiative to try to provide eSIMs to Palestinians in Gaza. Can you elaborate a little bit on the concept behind the initiative and what its purpose was?
So Connecting Gaza was born on the first day of the first blackout of communication and internet access in Gaza on October 28th. I felt so angry and frustrated after the failed attempts of providing internet to Gaza through Elon Musk's company, Starlink. And I was really worried about what's happening in Gaza during the blackout. And fortunately, I found one follower. She's Egyptian-Lebanese who was living abroad. And she told me, what about eSIMs? Do you think it can work in Gaza? I was like, let's try. Can you send me 2 eSIMs right now so I can try them out with someone in Gaza? And she sent the 2 eSIMs, and I kept scrolling X to find anyone from Gaza who has like weak or slight internet connection so we can like try to activate the eSIMs. Luckily, I found 2 journalists, Hind Khodari and Ahmed Madhoun, and I sent them the eSIMs, and it got successfully installed and they were connected. This is when the Connecting Gaza initiative started. And I posted a post on my personal social media account on Instagram asking my foreign followers from Europe and USA and Canada and across the world if they are willing to help, because I had so many followers and they were all supporting Palestine and sending me messages every day. We feel so helpless. We go to protests, but we feel it's not enough. We need to support Palestine. We don't know how. When Connecting Gaza was born, it was the time to call out for them to help me out in Connecting Gaza and to provide internet access to Palestinians. It was amazing because I have received thousands of QR codes of eSIMs during the first day on October 28th, and we have connected and we have put the priority first for the first 2 days for the journalists and medical staff in Gaza. And then after 24 to 48 hours, we were like, no. Everyone deserves to be connected. Everyone deserves to have proper communication and internet access. Everyone deserves not to be isolated and not to live in fear of the unknown. People deserve to be connected with the outside world, with their loved ones, and even with the hospitals and ambulances. But we kept the bigger, like, internet bundles for the journalists and doctors. And we were so happy that during the second blackout of the communication and internet access in Gaza, the eSIMs were working. And the journalists kept sending us messages and individuals from Gaza telling us that they can use the internet now through their eSIMs because they were saving the internet bundle until the next blackout. Many journalists were able to provide the horrible material of what's happening on ground in Gaza to their media platforms.
Can you describe for people who don't know, what exactly is an eSIM and how do you connect somebody in Gaza to an eSIM?
A SIM card, which has internet package, an extension of your internet package, but it's not physical. It gets activated through a QR code. So once you scan this QR code, you're like connected to the internet package of someone else. That's why when someone donates an eSIM, he's like donating an extension of his internet package to someone in Gaza.
That's incredible. That's really, truly incredible. I can speak to my own personal experience of having many, many friends who live in Gaza who, with the first blackout, were completely cut off. And actually, even before that, had been cut off because there was no place to refill your Jawal card, which is the local provider. There was no way to get access. And many, many, many people have actually benefited from it. Do you have any idea of how many eSIMs you've provided at this point in time?
So we have activated more than 50,000 eSIMs for people in Gaza. But the better side of this is the one eSIM can be used as a hotspot for many people. Like 2 days ago, I was activating an eSIM for a guy in Gaza, and he told me that the eSIM I provided is used as a hotspot for 4 houses. In Connecting Gaza team, we have analyzed the average number of connected phones to one eSIM can be, and the average number is 5. So we're talking about like from 200,000 people to 250,000 people in Gaza are now connected through the eSIMs.
That's really incredible. Mirna, I wanted to ask you, have you faced any limitations? Have there been attempts to try to block the use of eSIMs?
Yes, we have faced so many limitations, and we usually don't announce on what's happening behind the scenes of Connecting Gaza. So we can focus on the donations of eSIMs, on connecting people. But we had so many obstacles since we started connecting people through eSIMs. It was and still hard, but our belief in the Palestinian rights and our belief in what's happening in Gaza is really a horrible genocide and an ethnic cleansing is pushing us forward every day and is not letting us listen or surrender to the obstacles because we are focusing on providing these people their minimum rights of proper internet access and communication access.
I want to thank you for so many things, for being who you are, for this incredible initiative, for your lovely heart, for this work that you've been doing to make sure that Gaza doesn't face a permanent blackout. I think if it hadn't been for these eSIMs, we're already seeing gross atrocities, war crimes being committed. The one thing that the world can't say is that it's being done in the dark. And that's thanks to the efforts of you and so many people, so many volunteers who've come together with you to make sure that Gaza remains connected and that we're able to share what Israel's doing with the rest of the world.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening.
Joining us now is Avi Lewis, associate professor of geography at UBC and a member of the Jewish Faculty Network and Independent Jewish Voices. Avi, thanks for being here. You wrote an op-ed in the Globe and Mail recently saying Canada has a moral obligation to support South Africa's case. And since that was published, Israel had its day in court. It rejected South Africa's accusations of state-led genocide against the Palestinian population. What do you make of the case as a whole so far?
If you read South Africa's case, it's utterly devastating. I mean, it's 84 pages long. There's 574 footnotes, and they meticulously document the incitement statements from cabinet ministers and senior members of the Israeli government talking about flattening Gaza, talking about there are no innocents in Gaza. We're dealing with non-human animals. Every civilian attacked, the hospitals, the journalists killed, the civilians. And you look at Israel's case, and it's basically they just said, well, Hamas wants to commit genocide against us, so how could we be committing genocide against Hamas? Here's the problem, then. Hamas has not killed more than 100 Israeli children every day for more than 100 days. Hamas has not flattened entire neighborhoods, reducing them to dust. Hamas has not cut off food to Israel, using starvation as a weapon of war, according to Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, Israel's most storied human rights organization. Hamas has not destroyed a third of the buildings in Israel. Those are all things that Israel has done to the Palestinian people in Gaza. So I think the case is overwhelming. The problem is the court also has politics in it. There are 17 judges, I believe, and the United States is leaning on the process to try to exonerate Israel. So it'll be incredibly important to see, but the case is very, very strong.
Now, in your op-ed, you note Jewish people in Israel and here in Canada do not all agree. It's not a monolith. There has been widespread, or perhaps we could say very vocal support for Israel among a certain section of Canada's Jewish population. This is obviously such a difficult conversation. How do you find common ground with people who don't agree with you, be they fellow Jews or non-Jews?
Well, look, this is the task, to live together across our differences. And, you know, in the Jewish community, there's a huge diversity of opinions. I know so many people, at least four close friends, who have been waiting until their parents passed on to say how they really feel about Israel's apartheid system in that land and the crimes that are now being committed in Gaza. So there's a huge diversity of opinion within the Jewish community. Groups like the Jewish Federation of Vancouver and the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, CIJA, present themselves as the spokespeople of the entire community. They are Zionist groups who are pro-Israel, come what may, and they do not represent what I believe is a less and less silent majority of Jewish people who are standing up and saying, not in our name. You are killing children day after day after day. This is an asymmetric genocide. And we have to stand up and get on the right side of history. As Jews, we say never again about the Holocaust. We mean never again for anyone. At Passover, we say no one is free until everyone is free. And that means a free Palestine. That means a state in Palestine. And you saw that Netanyahu has never had any intention of allowing a Palestinian state in Sasha Petrosek's report. You saw that. And he even said more recently that for 30 years, he has been single-mindedly preventing the creation of a Palestinian state. This is truth time, people, and they never, ever intended to have a two-state solution.
And Avi, last question. We appreciate your time. Do you expect that more people, more Jews in Canada and elsewhere, will start speaking out?
Yeah, I mean, look, I regard these Zionist organizations as bullies. They accuse everyone who criticizes anything about Israel as being anti-Semitic. It's like a hammer. They're just smashing over and over again. Any criticism of Israel, anti-Semitic, anti-Semitic. They've rendered the term meaningless, and they've done a huge disservice to people fighting the real anti-Semitism, which is really out there, particularly because Israel is committing genocide and people around the world are angry about it, and that sometimes manifests itself in anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism has to be fought in a broad movement against racism. It can't be exceptionalized. It can't be only crimes against our people have to be singled out and denounced. And that's the problem. You know, that's why more and more Jews are standing up and saying, we are in solidarity with all people. We don't want an exceptional treatment here. We want a same standard of human rights and international law for everyone. And that includes Israel.
Avi Lewis, Associate Professor of Geography at UBC and member of the Jewish Faculty Network and Independent Jewish Voices. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Dan.
Today, the Israeli military acknowledged that they rolled into a cemetery, took bodies out of graves as part of what they say is a search for Israeli hostages' remains. But as the Israeli military put out that statement, we were completing our investigation into the Israeli military's desecration of cemeteries. And what we found is 16 cemeteries across Gaza damaged or destroyed. I do want to warn our viewers that they may find some of these images disturbing.
In Gaza, even the dead cannot escape the indignities of war. More than a dozen cemeteries like this one in Jabalia, desecrated by the Israeli military. Gravestones destroyed, soil upturned, treadmarks leaving little left for the living to honor their dead. This is that same graveyard before the war. 1 month later, a series of treadmarks can be seen on the northwestern edge. It is no exception. A CNN analysis of videos and satellite imagery found that 16 cemeteries have been damaged or destroyed by the Israeli military since it launched its ground offensive. As Israeli forces push deeper into Gaza, they crushed the graves of thousands of Palestinians between November and January. Janina Dill, co-director of Oxford University's Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, says destroying graveyards violates international law, except under very limited circumstances.
Cemeteries are not military objectives. They are, in fact, what international law would consider an object that is normally dedicated to civilian purposes, like places of worship generally. So this is protected from intentional attack. It can only be intentionally attacked or destroyed if it becomes a military objective.
In some cases, like this cemetery in the Shejaiya refugee camp, Israeli bulldozers turned cemeteries into military outposts, parking armored vehicles behind freshly raised berms. The damage is often deliberate and progressive. Over 2 weeks in December, the military bulldozed more and more of this cemetery east of Khan Yunis, building defensive fortifications. CNN witnessed firsthand the results of Israel's bulldozing of graveyards while embedded with Israeli forces last week. The armored personnel carrier CNN was traveling in drove right through this cemetery in Al Buraj, on a freshly bulldozed dirt road. And then there's this. Tombs opened at a cemetery in Khan Yunis this week. Bodies removed from their graves. In a statement, the Israeli military acknowledged exhuming bodies from the cemetery as part of its search for the bodies of Israeli hostages. An IDF spokesman could not account for the damage to the 16 cemeteries identified by CNN, but said that in some cases there is no other choice, providing this photo of what it says is a Hamas rocket launcher at a cemetery in Gaza. CNN could not independently verify where it was taken. The spokesman could not account for the military posts over graveyards, but said, "We have a serious obligation to the respect of the dead, and there is no policy to create military posts out of graveyards." In at least one case, the Israeli military appears to have taken pains to maneuver around a graveyard. The Deir el-Balah War Cemetery, which holds the remains of many Christian and Jewish soldiers from World War I, left intact, despite devastation all around. At the Al-Tufa Cemetery, a very different picture. Residents say bodies were uprooted by Israeli bulldozers.
We are currently retrieving the corpses of the martyrs that are present in the cemetery. The occupation forces have run over most of them with their bulldozers, and we've only identified a small number of corpses and martyrs. As for the rest, their identities remain unknown.
South Africa cited Israel's destruction of cemeteries as part of its case, arguing Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Israel denies the allegation, but experts say cemetery destruction could be evidence of Israel's intent.
There's huge symbolic meaning to the notion that not even the dead are left in peace. It suggests that disrespect towards the kind of spiritual life of your enemy, their cultural property and heritage, it's an evidence of an animus against your enemy that is unhelpful in this context.
The Israeli military is still desecrating graves in Gaza. At the Khan Yunis Cemetery, where the military dug up bodies this week, the damage is extensive and all too familiar. Tombs destroyed, shrouded bodies sticking out of the soil, the dead roused from their final rest.
And the Israeli military pointed to Hamas using some of these cemeteries for military purposes to justify what we've documented here. But what we're talking about isn't just strikes on these cemeteries. In some cases, it's the bulldozing of entire cemeteries, putting military outposts there, heavy armored vehicles driving right through the graves, showing very little care for the dignity of the dead. It speaks to something far more systematic than what the military acknowledged.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Mark your calendar every last Tuesday of the month and tune in to a special series of Soul Perspectives on 90.3 FM.
Tuesday from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m.
Broadcasting live from West Haven Community Center in NDG.
Tune in to a special series of Soul Perspectives on 90.3 FM.
This Tuesday, January the 30th, we have special guests Zoo 365 Fitness, Sita Gabriel,
and DJ TJ.
Last but not least, West Haven Teens and the After School Program will be blessing us with a special segment.
So, don't forget, tune in every last Tuesday of the month.
Soul Perspective, live from West Haven Community Center. Tune in.
See you then.
This is a West Haven and CQT co-presentation.
And this is Venus Radio at CKUT 90.3 FM, and it's noon on Thursday, January 25th. I'm live on air right now in the studio today, so happy Thursday to all the